The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Mr. President, Madam Peng, it is my pleasure to introduce the leader of a nation that is both very ancient and truly modern to a parliament that is both very ancient and truly modern. It is a reflection of our changing times that we have hosted no fewer than four prominent daughters and sons of Asia in our parliament in the past 3 years. Your country has seen a transformation in how its people work and in what they rightly expect for themselves, for their families, and for their society. The enormous challenge of how to deal with this falls to you and to your colleagues. Yet what China does, economically, but also politically, is seen by and relevant to not merely your own 1.5 billion citizens. It is seen by and relevant to billions more across the globe. The world will be watching and waiting expectantly on the outcome as the emerging superpower that is China takes its new place in the world. In this century, no country can exist in isolation in all matters, from international law to individual liberty. We should all aspire to be seen not merely as a powerful force in the world, but as a moral inspiration to it. In all this, we can usefully reflect on the wise Chinese words that it is better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. We very much hope that your time here will assist the process of illumination. On behalf of our Parliament, I invite you, Mr. President, to address us.
That is Speaker Burko in the House of Parliaments, or the Parliament in 2015, when he was introducing, as you heard there, the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, a dictator who, according to Human Rights Watch, this is a quote from them, systematically curtails a wide range of fundamental human rights, including freedom of expression, association, assembly, and religion. He prevents that. He prevents freedom of expression, association, assembly, and religion. This is a nation on the march. It's right now militarizing the South China Sea. It's working overtime to push the United States out of East Asia. It's got those island chains, those stationary aircraft carriers it's building in the South China Sea, some 800 miles off of its shore. And they're militarizing those man-made islands. As my father wrote last year, these militarized islands now function as forward bases for Beijing to challenge 7 decades of American naval dominance in the Pacific Rim. This, he said, should alarm the world. Well, it evidently doesn't alarm John Burko and many people in the Houses of Parliament. As he talked about there just less than 2 years ago, how modern this emerging superpower was. It's gone through this great transformation. It has many friends in Parliament. And no country can exist in isolation, and so we should rather light a candle and welcome him in. What a moral inspiration. Well, yesterday, this same House of Commons Speaker, John Bercow, he had this to say about a possible visit or speech from President Trump in the House of Commons. Clip two.
We value our relationship with the United States. If a state visit takes place, that is way beyond and above the pay grade of the Speaker. However, as far as this place is concerned, I feel very strongly that our opposition to racism and to sexism and our support for equality before the law and an independent judiciary are hugely important considerations in the House of Commons.
He says that speaking in the House of Commons is not an automatic right. It's an earned honor. And President Trump hasn't earned that honor. And so we shouldn't let him speak. That's John Bercow just yesterday. Now, I will say there's been a fair bit of a backlash because Theresa May's government, of course, is trying to, as we covered on this program a couple of weeks ago, it's trying to reestablish a strong link between the United Kingdom and America. It's trying to restore that special relationship, but the UK, just like the United States, I mean, we see Ephraim and Manasseh bitterly divided, split right down the middle. And so the backlash, there's been some coming from his own party, but most of it coming from the right. I mean, leaving aside, too, just the matters of protocol, the Speaker in the House of Commons, he's supposed to be, not biased. He's supposed to be impartial. He's supposed to be politically neutral. And you should see the video of that first clip that I played for you where he's introducing and almost bowing before the president of China. And then compare that with what he said yesterday about the president of the United States, about the president of Brother Manasseh. The speaker is supposed to be maintaining order, and yet there was, as you heard, quite a large applause. They're not even supposed to. Richard Palmer was telling me this morning that they're not even supposed to clap, and when they do, he's the one that's supposed to stop it. And when someone spoke up and asked about that, he said, well, sometimes it's better to just let the clapping carry on. The Telegraph says, Mr. Bercow has grossly exceeded his authority, seemingly believing himself entitled to wade deep into British foreign policy by dint of his office and his bottomless self-importance. That's some strong criticism coming from the Telegraph. He's obviously not trying to conceal his dislike of Donald Trump. But like I say, Britain's society it's split apart, it's polarized. Just like in the United States. But it's interesting, again, to see that half. The United States was led by the Antiochus administration for 8 years. And that 8 years was very much in line with the thinking of Mr. Bercow. Hosea 7 and verse 11 says that Ephraim is like a silly dove without sense. That's the New King James Version. It just means that they're so easily, so many times, so easily fooled. So easily fooled, naive, a naive nation, reaching out to dictators, reaching out to tyrants like we saw for so many years in the United States. Whether it was Cuba or Russia, well, that's happening now even. But it was the same with President Obama when he first came in. And over again, it's just history repeating itself. My father wrote a few years back, Ephraim or Britain has a silly dove foreign policy. And it says, no silly dove nation can endure in a world full of hawks and tigers. This is a strong warning to a once mighty nation. That's what Ephraim needs. That's what Britain needs. It needs a strong warning. When I heard those clips this morning, it just made me think of this section from the autobiography, Herbert Armstrong's autobiography, where he was talking about what he experienced at the first meeting of the United Nations, its first conference in San Francisco back in, I guess it was April or May of 1945. And of course, they were gathering together right at the tail end of World War II. And every speaker getting up there gave a very serious, very sobering speech. And just as an aside, just reading about that history and all of the broadcasting that Mr. Armstrong was doing during that time period, I mean, it's really helped me, I think, to just have a greater sense of urgency. I mean, we can't wait around until the bombs start dropping. That's what Mr. Armstrong was, that's the time period he was speaking in. The bombs were falling. They just weren't nearly as strong and as powerful as the bombs that exist on Earth today. Well, not at least toward the end of that war, with the two atomic bombs that exploded over Japan. Two cities, Nagasaki and Hiroshima. In any event, he's at this UN meeting in San Francisco, hearing all of these serious and sobering speeches. And he said in the autobiography, this is in page 613 of the version that we printed last year. But he said that they said we are gathered there, charged with the grave responsibility. He's just summarizing the content of those many speeches. Charged with the grave responsibility of producing a world organization that was civilization's last hope. They assured the delegates assembled that the survival of mankind depended on what they should do there. Mr. Armstrong said, I wondered whether they realized how true their words really were, so far as man's efforts to survive are concerned, or was it merely window dressing to be printed in the newspapers to impress the public that we're serious here, we're coming together, we'll solve the problems of this world. And he says, here were the world leaders, except for the Axis powers. They freely confessed, they put oratorical emphasis on the fact that the world is doomed unless the nations of the world can find a common ground for peace. He mentions all the different times the world had tried to come together to establish some sort of an organization built for peace. An organization established to bring peace. But they had all failed, one after another. He says, so here on the floor below us, under the same roof with us, were the leaders of the world's nations, trying once again to bring about world peace by human effort and organization. Truly, he says, it was a spectacle. Now, you might recall some of the details of Mr. Armstrong's experience there. He gave a blistering program on radio where he talked about how the men in those halls, they didn't have the solutions. He said the seeds were being planted for the next war, in fact. He saw human nature in all of its ugly colors. He says the speeches, I mean, they painted a grim picture. They said this is our last hope. They were serious. This time it was for real. And then what happened? Well, at every turn, the Russian foreign minister, the Russians, they balked, they opposed, they blocked, they fought, he said. And this was a meeting without the Axis powers, so you had the greatest enemies weren't even there present, but they still couldn't sort it out. Russia had its interests, and the Western nations had theirs. He talked about this, I guess the conference went on for a number of days, but he talked about how that there had been a press conference scheduled for the Secretary of State, Stettinius, I guess, the U.S. Secretary of State, and he just came storming into the room. He was, I think, 45 minutes late for the press conference. He had just had it out with the Russian defense minister, or the Russian equivalent to the Secretary of State, Molotov, who had blocked every move, who fought him at every turn. And finally, the U.S. Secretary of State, Mr. Armstrong said, was beginning to wake up with respect to Russia. Mr. Armstrong writes, "I think that up until that moment, the leaders of the United States government had naively believed that the Soviet Union was really our ally. President Roosevelt had felt that he could convert Stalin by kindness, by giving him everything he wanted, by appeasing him." And notice this. This is pretty amazing, this history. "During the war, I was not allowed to tell the public over the air the truth about Soviet plans or to say anything that was not complimentary about them." This is Mr. Armstrong talking about his own history as a broadcaster in the 1940s, saying that he could do nothing except compliment Russia or the Soviet Union. "I was given to understand this policy, which had gone out from the White House, that this was a policy that had gone out from the White House. More than once, I witnessed, to my shame, in newsreel theaters, a mild and restrained clapping when President Roosevelt's pictures were flashed on the screen, and then, when Stalin's picture was shown, wild applause, shouting, foot stomping shook the theater. And why? Well, because they're our ally. We're working together with Russia. And while they might be a little bit brutal, while many might consider them to be violators of human rights, we're going to kill them with kindness. We're going to give them everything that they want. We're going to appease them and convert them over to our way of thinking." This was even in the midst of World War II. These kinds of appeasement policies, reaching out to Russia over and over again. We've been talking about that a lot here lately. Happened again in 2009. Well, even before that, early on. What was it that President George W. Bush said? "I looked into Putin's eyes and he could read Putin. He knew what kind of a man he was." And then Barack Obama with the reset button. "Everything's going to be great. Just give me a little bit of time. I'll have more flexibility after the re-election." And then now, of course, the Democrats with their selective outrage, just outraged that President Trump would be reaching out to Vladimir Putin. And then on the other hand, you have Republicans who were denouncing this sort of behavior just a few years ago. Now doing everything that they can to justify President Trump's actions as he reaches out to convert Putin to kindness, to convert Putin to our way of thinking. Well, going back to this history, it says, even before Potsdam, when General Patton's forces were starting their drive toward Berlin after the Channel crossing, academic psychologists convinced the administration at Washington that the Allies owed it to Russia to remove Russian fears of future German aggression by giving the communists most of Eastern Europe. That's why General Patton's forces were halted on the drive toward Berlin and forced to draw back from territory already conquered. And so the U.S. effort, it pulled back as Germany was about to be defeated. And what that did is it gave Russia time, or the Soviet Union time, to devour those Eastern European nations. Mr. Armstrong talks about the time in March of 1945 when he knew that Patton's forces were making good progress in their move toward Germany, and once you get into Germany and defeat Germany, the war's over. That's it. And so he was about to go on the air one Sunday morning at 8:30 a.m., and as his custom was, he liked to update his listeners on what was happening right then and there in the news. And so he wanted to get the latest headlines about this move on Germany. So he scanned the news teletype for the day to see if Germany was now occupied and no dispatch came in. And he arranged for the station manager to come in with the latest if it happened even during the middle of the program. But as he says, no such news came. Not that half hour, not that day, not for many weeks. Why? The Soviet rulers did not want to plow immediately through for a quick knockout of Germany. So the Soviets were coming from one side and the Americans from the other. They didn't want to plow through Germany, not yet. It says instead they left adequate forces just outside the German border and sent their invading divisions on south to conquer and occupy such Eastern Europe countries as Czechoslovakia, Romania, Hungary, Yugoslavia, and Albania, setting the Russian boot on those lands as conquered satellite countries before bringing the war to an end. At the same time, the Kremlin, with the help of the theoretical psychologists, prevailed on Washington to send orders through to General Eisenhower to pull General Patton back to prevent ending the war until the Soviets had occupied all the East European satellite countries. That's silly dove foreign policy for you right there. Well, we'll convert them to our way of thinking by kindness. Give them what they want. Give them what they want. I mean, after all, the German threat was real. And some were thinking and saying, Russia deserves those Eastern satellites. Mr. Armstrong said, finally, sometimes I wonder how gullible statesmen and heads of government, sometimes I wonder how gullible statesmen and heads of government can get. I continually pray, Thy kingdom come, Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. He says, well, we are, with this particular revision of the autobiography, 41 years closer to that happy world tomorrow than we were then. And then we could add to that, now that it's been another 25 or 30 years on, we're certainly drawing closer to the rule of Jesus Christ on this earth. But look at all of these prophecies being fulfilled, and then the history too, just the history repeating itself and having to learn the same lessons all over again. But this time, as I've said this week, as I said last week, this time, I mean, we're talking about nations, China, we're talking about nations, Russia, that have nuclear bombs. That have nuclear bombs. And then you look at the state of our nations. I mean, still reaching out naively in hopes of making peace, in hopes of making nice with our enemies, thinking that we can convert them to our way of thinking, the Western way of thinking. Hosea 2, it talks about the blessings here that God bestowed upon our nations, Ephraim in particular, the British Empire. It says, For she did not know that I gave her corn and wine and oil and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. Verse 9 says, Therefore will I return and take away my corn in the time thereof and my wine in the season thereof, and will recover my wool and my flax given to cover her nakedness. God gave us all of these blessings, all of this power. And yet, as he says right here, our people haven't recognized the God who gave us the blessings. The people of Ephraim here, they don't acknowledge that it's God who made Great Britain great in the first place. But it's certainly not great today. And really, It's between a rock and a hard place. There's many that really want to see us, or Britain, I should say, reach out and make peace and appease foreign nations like Russia, China, Iran. And then, as I covered the other day, a couple of weeks ago, I mean, there's certainly a group or half the nation that really likes the fact that the United States and Britain are drawing closer again. Britain really is weak and hollowed out, cake unturned, it says in that same prophecy. It's interesting when you look at that that time period just a couple of years ago. We discussed some of this on the radio back when the Chinese president made his much publicized visit to Britain in toward the end of October or toward the end of 2015. I think it was in October. But there were all those articles coming out about, in the case of the New York Times, Britain's drift from the global stage becomes an election issue. Britain's drift from the global stage, no longer an influential power. As Britain's malaise grows, so do worries for the United States. I mean, this is becoming a serious, serious threat. The fact that Britain can no longer influence and protect its interests the way that it once did. One observer said, this is again from a couple of years ago, speaking of Britain's disarmament, that it hasn't disarmed this fast since the 1930s. History is repeating itself. Just lavishing praise and honor on dictators, on the worst of the worst, as far as human rights is concerned. And then you see brothers squabbling, fighting, hurling insults at one another. This from Real Clear Defense. This is more recent now, just from a couple days ago. It says the United Kingdom's decision to leave the EU is billed as a revival of a global Britain. This is great. Many of those who supported Brexit and who do like Trump, who would have Trump speak at the House of Commons, they think this is, as I said 2 weeks ago, this is Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher all over again. It says, but is today's Royal Navy capable of ensuring this seafaring land? This seafaring island, a place on the world stage? And can the British government guarantee support for the Royal Navy once it inevitably tasks it with protecting British interests around the world? It says at Real Clear Defense, since the loss of the Empire and the end of the Cold War, the Navy has been treated by subsequent governments as a disposable, superfluous tool, a relic of the past, stuck in the traditions of a bygone era. Now listen to these stats. This is stunning. It's shocking, these figures. We're going to have to make an infographic out of this for the Trumpet magazine. It says in 1945, there were over 1 million men and 900 ships in the Royal Navy. That's 1945. 1 million men in the Navy, the Royal Navy, and 900 ships. It says by 1986, so this is Margaret Thatcher's era, right in the middle, by 1986, the Navy had at its disposal 70,000 sailors. So more than 90% drop off. 70,000 sailors, 30 submarines, 48 destroyers and frigates, 7 amphibious vehicles, and 3 aircraft carriers. That's just 1986. A little over 30 years ago. But then you compare the figures today to 1986. Today it has 33,000 sailors, 11 submarines, 19 destroyers and frigates, and 3 amphibious vehicles. 11, 19, and 3, and just 33,000 sailors. In 1945, it was 1 million. This article says that right now there are more admirals than there are fighting ships in the Royal Navy. They've got more admirals than they have ships. That reminds me also of something Mr. Armstrong said about that UN meeting when he met the admiral of the Chinese Navy in 1945. This was under Chiang Kai-shek. It was before the communist takeover. But he met this admiral of the so-called Chinese Navy. He was in this glamorous uniform. And he said even the Arab representatives at that conference with their flowing robes didn't look as nice as this admiral over the Chinese Navy. He had every possible color on his bright uniform. But as Mr. Armstrong said, there was only one unusual thing about the presence of the admiral, of the Chinese Navy. He says nationalist China had no navy. They didn't have a single warship. And then he said that's probably the reason why all the glamour was concentrated on the admiral's uniform. That's the direction they're headed in Britain. This article from Real Clear Defense says Britain can no longer provide the capabilities it once did on a scale which would be useful for global power. Peter Roberts, the director of military sciences at Royal United Services Institute, highlights that the UK no longer has a sufficient number of submarines to deter Russian activity in the Arctic. Russia's moving on the Arctic. China's moving on the South China Sea. Chinese dictators welcome in the House of Commons, but not the President of the United States. It says, and there's another story in the Independent today, by the way, that says that it just mentioned there in that last quote I gave to you, that it doesn't have a sufficient number of submarines to deter Russian activity in the Arctic. And then, according to the Independent, British warships are so noisy that Russian submarines can hear them 100 miles away. The Independent says poor equipment and botched procurement deals could hinder Britain's ability to defend itself in the face of a serious military attack. Well, this other article, the one I quoted earlier, Real Clear Defense, it concludes by saying how low the morale is in the Royal Navy, and I mean, you can understand why. Look at the numbers. Look at the numbers. It says the risk at the moment is that over the next 20 years, the UK will become just another generic maritime force, one that will most likely have to rely upon American surface ships to protect British capital vessels if they go into harm's way. They really are running out of choices. I mean, you can put your faith in the lovers, but Hosea says that's not going to work out. You continue on in chapter 2, Hosea 2 and verse 10. It says, "And now will I discover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and none shall deliver her out of my hand." It's going to be Britain's lovers that discover her lewdness. It's going to be those Gentile nations that she reaches out to. So it's not going to work, putting your faith in lovers. What about putting your faith in Manasseh? Won't work either. Hosea 5 and verse 5 says that all three of us fall together. It says in verse 7 of that same chapter that it happens in a month. Our only choice, if you get anything from all of this, our only choice is to put our faith and our trust in God. To look to God to deliver us. To look to God for salvation. To look to God for protection. At thetrumpet.com right now, we have featured at the very top, UK House of Commons, racist Trump not welcome. It has some of the content that we've that we've covered for you or discussed here in the first segment. Xi Jinping, I mean, he's welcome anytime. He's a revolutionary. He's an innovative thinker. He's leading a revolution in industry that took Britain 2 centuries. He's doing it in 2 decades. He's the emerging world power, superpower, in fact. What a modern nation. How much good he's done, not only for his own people, 1.5 billion of them, but for the whole world as well. Donald Trump, no thank you. Stay away. Don't come into the House of Commons. Well, as we see so many aspects of the history from World War II and before World War II repeat itself, or repeat themselves, it's the prophecies, together with the history, that we've really got to be grounded in when we come back. I see that I don't have a whole lot of time left, but we'll go into a brief study that kind of follows on what we talked about briefly yesterday, about just how close God is to all of us if we'll just go after him, if we'll just draw near to him, if we'll just dig into his inspired word, the Holy Bible. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us this week. You can send comments to the program at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The world is hopelessly confused about Bible history and prophecy. Understanding the Daniel 2 image could clear up most of that confusion. The Daniel 2 image gives an overview of history and prophecy like nothing else in the Bible. The Bible is a masterful work that should be studied in its entirety. The book of Daniel and the images described therein actually unlock the meaning of the prophecies in the book of Revelation. Our free booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, explains the incredible prophecies contained in these two books. Studied alongside your Bible, this booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, will bring the history and prophecy of your Bible to life. Request your free copy today. There is absolutely no cost or obligation. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
My father sent out a coworker letter just the other day. I think it might have been put in the mail yesterday, so many of you that received that letter probably haven't gotten it quite yet. But he says early on in the letter that it has become increasingly clear that we have just a few prophetic moments left before the return of Christ. Nothing is more important now than staying close to God and fulfilling his commission. Just look at the pace of world events, the pace of fulfilled prophecy, prophesied events unfolding before our eyes. And then the pace, too, of the activities in this church, on this radio station, at thetrumpet.com, the Trumpet Magazine, the Key of David program, just the work in general, the work in Edmond, the work at Edstone here. It says over in 1 Peter 4, verse 1, that we need to arm ourselves with the mind of Christ. That, like I said at the end of the first segment, I mean, that's our sure defense. To be armed with the mind of Christ. And how do we do that? Well, verse 7, this is 1 Peter 4, it says, "But the end of all things is at hand. Be you therefore sober, watch, and watch unto prayer." Be sober. Watch world events. Watch unto prayer. God says here through Peter that because time is so short, this is what we've really got to be concentrating on. As my father says in the Peter booklet, we've got to carefully watch our prayer life. We've got to keep our minds on the return of Christ. We've got to make sure that we're breaking through to God. Because the end of all things is at hand. In the booklet, my father says, keep yourself stable so that when you talk to God, you don't waste your prayer life. We can't afford to waste those moments in going through the autobiography. It's just amazing to me how many wonderful examples are there about prayer, about the relationship that Mr. Armstrong had with his maker, with his creator. He tells the story from 1943, after they had been on this national radio station, WHO in Des Moines. He had a one-year contract, but about five months in, he received news from them that there were some on the station that wanted to kick him off the air because they said, well, he got the station or the contract because of his uncle's influence there in Des Moines, and he got a discount, a religious rate, when it should have been the commercial rate. And so we need to kick him off right away. Well, Mr. Armstrong made a trip to Des Moines to plead his case before management and said, hey, look, we have a contract here. At least let us finish through the year. And there was a lot of resistance. And he left the room. This is on page 585 of his autobiography. It says, I was shown to a reception room outside. I was alone there and quickly knelt before a chair and appealed to the God of heaven. He had opened this giant door. He had said no man can shut doors he opens. I asked him to intervene and to save his work. It's God's problem. God's the one that opened the door. He's the one that said no man can shut it. And so let's leave it in God's hands. And there was Mr. Armstrong. He looked probably both ways. He saw no one was around. And he got down on his knees in that reception area and appealed to the God of heaven. Well, he was called back into the manager's office. And after discussing it further, the man said, well, we'll honor our contract. But it's only for a year, so that means you've got another 6.5 months, which is, Mr. Armstrong would have liked to have stayed on the station, but it at least gave him some time to get another station with comparable coverage so that the listeners could be educated about where to listen into the program. As it happens, he got another station right away. And so for a time, there was about a six-month overlap, and he had the message going on two really powerful radio stations. Look over at Romans 12, if you're following along in your Bible. We went through this just this morning in Epistles of Paul class. We're in Romans right now, having finished Romans 12, and this is right in the middle of some wonderful instruction that Paul's giving to brethren on how to be a living sacrifice, how to make sacrifices for God, as he says in verse 1 of the chapter. This is your reasonable service. I beg of you, Paul said to the people, because of the mercies of God, become a living sacrifice. Present your bodies as a sacrifice to God. How do you do that? Well, picking it up in verse 10, it says, Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor, preferring one another, not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, and it says, continuing instant in prayer. Instant in prayer. Another word for that could be constant. Be constant in prayer. And I think that example from the autobiography, it's a good example of what it means to be instant in prayer. Mr. Armstrong constantly took matters, big and small, before God's throne. And he did it whenever and wherever he could. Phillips' translation says, steadfastly maintain the habit of prayer. We talk often in this church about that longer block of prayer that we need to be getting in the morning, aiming for an hour every day. But how consistent are we in just going before God at that instant when you have something huge come up, when you have an important decision to make, when you have a difficult task right in front of you, or when you experience an unexpected trial? How quick are we to drop to our knees when the need is pressing? It's amazing, really. If you're normally accustomed to just praying for the most part in the morning, it's amazing how fast you can veer off course if you don't remain instant in prayer, if you don't keep that conversation going through the day. Paul said also in 1 Thessalonians 5 to pray without ceasing. Pray without ceasing. It's obviously not saying you just, you know, do prayer and nothing else. It's talking about the frequency. It's talking about not having long lapses between your prayers to God. Of course, there's the big, foundational, fervent, effectual discussion that gets your day off to a right start. But then there's also the repeated requests through the day for help, for intervention, just to make sure that God is guiding us. There's a parable in Luke 18. I won't take the time to go over there, but it's the story or the parable of this woman, this widow who went before the judge, and she said, "Avenge me of my adversary," and he wouldn't do it, but she just kept going. And the judge finally said, "She troubles me, so I'll avenge her. She's wearying me." And it says in verse 6 of Luke 18, "And the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge says, and shall not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night?" Day and night. There's examples in the Old Testament of Daniel praying morning, noon, and night. Same with David in the Psalms. "Evening, morning, and noon will I pray and cry aloud." I'm sure those men got the bulk of their prayer in the morning. But then they maintained a spirit of prayer, an earnestness, an effectual, fervent way about their conversation with God right through the day. There's another example in the autobiography, page 589, where Mr. Armstrong was visiting with the ABC network in Denver, a 5,000-watt station, and he had called as he was passing through another trip he was taking. He called the station manager and asked if he could give him a pitch for the World Tomorrow program, and the man was just very abrupt and told him bluntly that, "We don't take your religious programming. There's no time for this, and I can't meet with you." Well, Mr. Armstrong persisted and worked his way in to get a meeting, as it happened, and then he had to run back to his hotel room to get the two 15-minute tapes that these stations would listen to preview whether or not they'd approve the program or not. And listen to this. It says, I had to return to my hotel room to obtain transcription discs, telling him I would return in 10 minutes. I walked rapidly, almost ran to the hotel. On the way, I realized, belatedly, why I had met with such a negative reception. I had failed to take this call on KVOD up with the one who I was working for. It had long before become custom to pray before any call or conference of any import, asking God's direction, wisdom, and to give me favor in the eyes of the man with whom I had to deal. Well, he goes on and talks about how important it was for him throughout the day to receive divine guidance from God. And he said, later, "In my eagerness, I had gotten ahead of God." Now, Mr. Armstrong probably had a good prayer session that morning, but as the events of the day unfolded, he got carried away, as he said there, and then something big came up, and he didn't pray about it right before going into the meeting. He says, and right here, perhaps I may give the reader an example of what God's word. Well, to finish the story, he got the tapes. He was half running back to his meeting, and he was praying on the sidewalk silently as he was hurrying back to make it to this meeting. And he went into the meeting knowing. He asked God first to forgive him. He was repentant. He knew he should have brought God into it first. And then he went into the meeting knowing that there would be a mind change, and there was. And those with the station, they sat down and they listened to all 30 minutes of that preview, when most stations just would listen to the first five or six. Now they were all of a sudden converts almost. There was a real change in their attitudes. And Mr. Armstrong attributed that to prayer. He said in the autobiography that in my eagerness, I had gotten ahead of God. I had gone on my own without asking for either guidance or favor. He hadn't asked for guidance. He hadn't asked for favor. He was in there on himself, on his own. And so he asked for God to forgive. And then a miracle happened. He says here, and right here, perhaps I may give the reader an example of what God's word means by the admonition, pray without ceasing, or as Jesus said, pray always. He means we must be continually in a spirit of prayer. And he means to pray constantly over even little things that arise. That's what it means to pray without ceasing, or to be instant in prayer. As it says in the old correspondence course, we should, as many other scriptures show, be in an attitude of prayer. It is possible to let your mind dwell on God as you go about your daily routine. Speak to him silently as you work or play. Let him direct your every thought and action. Let God guide you. It says further, you should always feel free to take all of your innermost thoughts to God in prayer and ask him to guide you. Talk over everything with him. Ask him to guide your daily life. When you read some of the Psalms about King David and just the amount of meditation he put in, thinking on God and his way of life, meditating on God's laws. I mean, that's obviously an individual that had an especially close relationship with God. I mean, the Bible says David was a man after God's own heart. David was instant in prayer. He was praying always. He was always in that spirit of prayer, as Mr. Armstrong said that we should be. And if we do that, as the correspondence lesson brings out, it is possible. It's actually possible to let your mind dwell on God as you go about your daily routine. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us this week, td@kpcg.fm. That's all we have time for. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you again tomorrow. We'll